Judiciary's committee is called to order. We have a full committee today consisting of myself, Senator McGuire, my vice chair, Senator Coghill, Senator Machicki, Senator Costello, and Senator Wilikowski. First thing we're going to take up today is the confirmation hearing of the lieutenant governor successor, and the conferee is Craig Fleener. Craig, are you there?
Hello.
Hello. Tell us why you would like to be the lieutenant governor's successor.
Well, it's of course a privilege and an honored position, and even really to be offered that opportunity is a privilege and scary all wrapped up into one. But it's probably something that I have been striving for my whole life, which is public service and trying to do more and good things for Alaska and Alaskans. In fact, I think most jobs that I've had since I was young were intended to be about service to the country and service to the state. So I think that it's another step in the progression of how I can serve Alaska better.
Excellent. So tell us a little bit about yourself. One of the things we like to do in our committee is just kind of get to know the people that are in front of us. Just take us a little bit back, you know, as far as you want to go. What brought you to Alaska, some things about yourself that would make you, let's say that the worst happened and you ended up succeeding Byron Mallott, and you ended up becoming lieutenant governor. We want to know a little bit about you.
Yes, Madam Chair. Thank you. So I'm born and raised in Alaska, originally from Fort Yukon, and would have been born in Fort Yukon had it not been for the flood. And there was also a flood in Fairbanks around the same time, 67. And so I think that was the reason my mom came down to Anchorage, and I was ultimately born in Anchorage in 1967 and spent most of the time back in Fort Yukon. I lived a little bit in Chalkeetsik and in Circle as well. And I had a stepdad that was in the military, and I would stay with him from time to time outside. But grew up mostly in Fort Yukon. And on the career side of my life, I was in the military. I'm still in the National Guard. That's about 27 years now, 4 years active duty Marine Corps, and the rest Alaska National Guard. And I currently serve as a senior intelligence officer of the 176th Wing down here in Anchorage. And I really enjoy being in the National Guard. It's a great organization to be part of. It has a terrific mission of defending Alaska and participating in the broader defense of the country. And it's something I look to staying into for quite a bit longer. I've also done tribal management. I worked in tribal government in Fort Yukon for about 16 years, I think, and I worked for the Native Village of Fort Yukon and also the Council of Athabascan Tribal Governments, where I got my feet wet in tribal government and then started working on natural resources issues and ultimately became a wildlife biologist, focusing mostly on moose and bison and a couple of endangered species issues. I did a little bit of fisheries research, but not because I like doing fisheries research. I was just the only biologist around, and got to participate in some salmon and some whitefish research up there as well. Participated as the executive director of CATG for a few years, where I oversaw healthcare, education, and natural resources management. Ultimately, that led to my working at the Department of Fish and Game for 5 years, and what caused me to move to Anchorage. I moved to Anchorage in 2008 and became the director of the Division of Subsistence and then the Deputy Commissioner of Fish and Game, and now as the Arctic Policy Advisor. So all of my jobs actually have an interesting connection because of the connections that all of them have to the Arctic. It's really a privilege now to serve in this position, something I've sort of been building up for not knowingly, it just sort of happened, but building up for decades now in all the work that I've done, whether it's in healthcare or human dimensions issues or military issues from an Arctic sovereignty perspective, and natural resources management, from moose management to subsistence management, and et cetera. So that's kind of my history from the working side.
Love it. Excellent. Questions for Mr. Fleener. Senator Coghill,
thank you for stepping up. And one of the things that I was really pleased that the governor appointed you to be our Arctic guy, because I think you probably, both with the military experience, your traveling, have a pretty good grasp on the fact that Alaska is an international state, as well as, notwithstanding our own internal dynamics. Is there something in the Lieutenant Governor's office for you that, as you eye, that you would like to see us do better at, Craig?
Well, I think as the Lieutenant Governor, and of course you all are aware that I ran for Lieutenant Governor, and one of the things that I was very interested in doing is making sure that we have the best voting system possible, and I think that there are always ways to improve it. I think that there are ways of bringing costs down and ensuring that we have full access across the spectrum. Now, of course, I'm not doing that job, so I haven't had the opportunity to dig into the nuts and bolts of some of the difficulties we've had along the way, but I know that I'm pretty sure that we all share the common goal of ensuring that all Alaskans have as great of access to the ability to vote as possible. And so that's been one of my strong desires, is to making sure that we improve that system. And really, I would like to have a goal of making it one of the best systems in the country.
Yeah, thank you. And Madam Chair, I think that his experience would be, wealthy for us. And hopefully, as we move along, you'll have some input into the Lieutenant Governor's as he stands right now. So thank you for being willing to do this. I greatly appreciate it.
Thank you, Senator.
Thank you. Senator Costello.
Thank you, and thank you, Craig, for your willingness to serve Alaska, both previously and now in this capacity. I just have two questions. One is, if circumstances came to be where you were serving as Lieutenant Governor, have you thought about, would you keep the current Lieutenant Governor's staff, or do you see yourself bringing in some of your own folks? And then secondly, again, if that were to occur, do you see yourself moving your family to Juneau, or would you serve mainly from Anchorage?
Thank you, Senator. I think that I would have to take a look at each of the staff before I willingly said I was going to make a change. But the way that things are run now is very open. There's more of a partnership in operation going on. Of course, the Lieutenant Governor does have his own staff, as does the Governor, but we're operating in a very partner-oriented environment where we're trying to work together as closely as possible across the spectrum. And I think that's been very healthy for us here. And it of course opens the door up for more expertise to be made available, especially in light of the cuts that we've had to face and the reduced number of staff overall in the governor's office. So I have a good working relationship, I think I do anyways, with all of the staff here, and I'm very comfortable with them. Of course, the Division of Election staff is a different story. That is staff that I think belongs directly to the Lieutenant Governor, and I don't have anything on my mind right now about changing staff, but I would certainly look at that if I was put in that position. In terms of, would you please repeat the second question?
Oh, I was just curious if you had thought about whether you would move your family to Juneau and serve here, or if you would be based out of Anchorage, or if you would come down on your own and leave your family in Anchorage.
I think I would serve where best needed, and I think the Lieutenant Governor is probably needed in Juneau. It would be like being governor and not being in Juneau, so I think that would be that there's a couple of positions that have to be in Juneau. I absolutely think that Governor and Lieutenant Governor need to be there.
Thank you.
Senator Kako.
Greg, for the service you've done to Alaska already, you have proven without a shadow of a doubt that you are definitely a public servant. One of the areas, though, that is hardly ever noticed is the work that you've done on the State Emergency Response Commission. And I, for one, very grateful for your input into that. We still got a long ways to go, but it's part of being a growing state, but for your military service as well. So thank you, and thank you for being willing to serve.
Thank you, Senator.
Thank you, Craig. I too, echo those comments. I've enjoyed serving with you on Arctic issues, and look forward to working with you in the future. We have one person on the line, Doug Vincent Lang, who wishes to testify. Doug, are you there?
Yes, I am. How are you doing, Senator?
I'm doing fine. If you'd offer your name and then your affiliation.
Okay. I'm Doug Vincent Lang. I'm from Anchorage, and I have no affiliation other than representing myself today.
Okay. Go ahead and offer your testimony.
Okay. I urge the committee to look a little bit deeper into Mr. Fleener's background. I think the person that should be nominated for Lieutenant Governor of our state should be a role model to all Alaskans. And I think there's been some questionable Facebook postings by Mr. Fleener in the past that I think I sent to the chair. And also there's been some questionable travel when he was a state employee with Fish and Game. And as we move into the deep cuts into the future, that they're going to require travel restrictions and a variety of other things, you know, I think the Lieutenant Governor would have to be a role model as you move forward into those types of things. And again, I just urge you to look a little bit closer and a little bit deeper before just passing this on to the larger Senate and take a deeper look at this. Again, I think this is a question of role model, and I think this person should be a role model for Alaskans if you confirm him to move forward. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for Doug Vincent Lang? Thank you. Okay, with that, any further comments for Mr. Fleener? Okay, anyone here in the audience wishing to testify? Anyone else online? Okay, hearing and seeing none, then I will make the motion that we forward Craig Fleener's name on as the Lieutenant Governor's successor, with individual recommendations onto the full body. And we'll go ahead and take it at ease to sign the document. Back on the record, Mr. Fleener, we're going to give you an opportunity to respond to the Facebook posting question.
Yes, Madam Chair, thank you. So I was actually sent a copy of the Facebook post, and what I think it is a post that was on someone else's Facebook. If I'm not sure if you have a copy of it in front of you or not, but if you notice, it says in the top of the page via someone else's name. I don't want to mention their name, but it says via them. So it was actually their Facebook post that I commented on, and because of that, it ended up on my page, but it wasn't my posting.
Yeah, so we're distributing, we'll distribute it. Oh, boy. Hopefully distributing it here soon. Senator Machicki.
Just to be fair, Mr. Fleener, and I didn't have any questions for you. I just, we even in this industry now, we do review postings as it's a demonstration of one's character, what they're willing to have on their page or willing to even comment on their page. And my understanding is this wasn't anything serious, the particular posting, but it's a good on the record note out to anyone who's thinking of doing anything in their lives that think about what's on your page. And I will review that as we go forward here, Mr. Fleener. I do want to see the post, and like I heard from other committee members, that this particular post was not something outside of what folks would think as being somewhat typical on a Facebook page, I suppose. So I wanted to get it on the record since we had someone who testified previously.
Thank you, Senator.
Thank you.
Senator Coghill.
Greg also has mentioned something on inappropriate travel. Was there some kind of a formal charge or anything that we should be aware of that you can straighten out?
Well, so I was just given a copy of the TA in question, and there was a trip that I went to Portland for a Association of Fish and Wildlife Agencies meeting, and on this trip I took my wife with me, which is a normal practice. You pay for their own way, and I think my wife traveled with me 3 or 4 times over my 5 years at Fish and Game because we worked so many hours. It was really the only opportunity to go do something, and so many people took their spouses with them when they went somewhere. So we went to Portland, and what typically happens is that I pay the entire cost of the travel, usually. And so I would pay for the airfare and the hotel. In this case, I didn't pay for the hotel, but I paid for the airfare. And what usually happens is I pay all of the costs, and I get reimbursed I get reimbursed for the part that's owed to me, that I paid out of pocket that would have been a state expense. And so that's what happened with the airfare. And I think the issue in question is the use of a vehicle. And I think the problem with this TA, actually, is it was right around the time that I resigned my position to run for lieutenant governor. So I was never actually given the opportunity to provide a reimbursement if one was necessary. So my being concerned about doing things right, I've actually talked to our ethics guy today, and I also sent an email to the admin folks at Fish and Game to say if there is an issue here, I need to know about it because I need to pay this bill. So I think part of the problem was the transition. It happened right about the time I left to run for lieutenant governor, and there was just no communication after that point. And on the travel authorization, you'll see that there's no traveler signature for the reimbursement. But I also didn't receive any contact saying you owe $30-whatever for fuel or whatever the issue might be. So I'm waiting to hear back, and if it is an issue with fuel, it certainly isn't an issue with the airfare or the hotel, because I paid for the airfare. And the only issue it could be is the rental car, because on the last day of the travel, we drove outside of Portland a little ways, and so I'm waiting to hear back on that right now. But it certainly wasn't done with any malice. Like I said, if every time the TAs are submitted, they get reviewed, and if there's anything that should be reimbursed or should not be reimbursed, that's made clear at that point in time. And I think the problem with this TA is that I just was not available during that transition out of this position.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay. Any further questions?
I have one follow-up.
Senator Machicki.
Mr. Fleener, has the image been removed?
It was never on my, I guess it was on my Facebook, but I couldn't remove it because it was from the other guy. But I went and looked through my entire Facebook when this popped up, and I couldn't find it anywhere. So it's not on my Facebook anymore.
Thank you.
Well, social media, it is a bear, isn't it?
Yes, Madam Chair, and you also have to be careful because you never know if somebody else is posting stuff on your page, because that's something they can do as well.
I know. It's very true. Well, I appreciate you answering the questions, and they are very serious. And Senator Machicki's right that it's important. We've had people come before us this year or potentially come before us this year that have questionable posts, and they can reveal people's character. So I appreciate you answering it. If posts seemed racist or sexist or those kinds of things, people would want to talk about them. But I don't see anything to me that is standing out as a big concern. I will note, though, that our recommendations go forward without any, you know, particular signal to vote. We all get to vote how we vote, but I'm supportive of you. And I'll just say that I really enjoyed being with you in Washington, D.C. Both Representative Bob Herron and I did, having you join us in our meetings. We felt like they were enhanced by having the other branch of government join us in our Arctic meetings. So I appreciate that. Will you be in D.C. next week?
I will not, unfortunately, Madam Chair. I have to be in Whitehorse for the senior Arctic officials meeting, but I do think that the three of us need to gang up on D.C. again. It was a terrific opportunity to let everybody else in the world know what we think about the Arctic and the direction that we think it needs to go.
I thought so, too. Well, thank you. Any further questions for Mr. Fleener? Okay. Thank you very much, Mr. Fleener. Anyone else, again, here in the audience wishing to testify as a result of the information? Anyone online? Okay, hearing and seeing none, then public testimony has been closed. And again, we have the document in front of us, signing our names to forward the name onto the full body with individual opportunities to vote at the time of that full confirmation. Okay, at this time, I'm going to bring up Senate Bill 49. And I'm going to have Nicole Nelson is online, and Genevieve Watusek is going to come forward. We had this bill up on Friday, and we walked through it. Senator Wilkowski, you were the only one. I just want to bring you up to speed. We had testimony. We had questions. Really, they were coming from Senator Coghill. I think we answered most of them. There was perhaps one outstanding question that we have a letter on, and Genevieve is going to answer that at this moment in time. And we also have Nicole Nelson online. So,
through the chair, Senator McGuire, Genevieve Watusek, staff to you. And in your backup packets today was a zero fiscal note from the courts, and I've got Nancy Mead behind me to answer any questions on that. And then a letter from Nicole Nelson talking about the types of cases that they are prohibited from taking, and those include criminal cases, abortion-related litigation, representation of undocumented immigrants, class actions, representation of prisoners, representation of those evicted from public housing, redistricting activities, and cases where a private attorney would take the case. And if there's any follow-up, I know I have her on the line.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Coghill.
I just want to express my thanks. I mean, I looked on a different website, I had it written down here, American Bar Association, and I either misunderstood what they were saying, and then so I went on the legal services and printed it out, but I printed out the section that they didn't represent. So,
got it.
So thanks for letting me dig as deeply as I thought I could. I'm not really supportive of the idea, but I wanted to know those things specifically. So anyway, I'm grateful. I think they did an excellent job of answering the questions, convinced me of the nobility of the exercise. So I probably won't ask any further questions.
Okay.
Thank you.
Excellent. Any further questions from anyone here on Senate Bill 49? Anyone here in the audience wishing to testify on Senate Bill 49? Anyone online? Okay. If not, I would take a motion. Senator Machicki?
I move Senate Bill 49 to the next committee of reference, or are we bringing it? Yes. With attached fiscal notes. Sorry, I wasn't prepared.
That's perfect.
To make a motion.
Okay. Okay. You're on the fly.
Okay.
Individual recommendations. Okay, so the motion on the table is to move Senate Bill 49 with individual recommendations and accompanying fiscal notes out of this committee onto the next. Is there any objection? Okay, hearing and seeing none, it's moved. So we'll pass around the report and move on to the next bill. That is Senate Bill 5 regarding restitution, property, and income loss. And then we'll go to Senate Bill 49, and then we'll be done for the day. So Senate Bill 5, Senator Machicki. And we also have Chris Nettles with Geotech Alaska and Rachel Petro.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll just discuss it a little bit and hand it off to Chuck Kopp, my staff on this bill.
Welcome, Mr. Kopp.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Are we waiting? Or?
We're okay.
Keep charging forward?
Yeah.
Okay.
Charge.
This bill is fresh out of Labor and Commerce. It's a little bit about property theft crime in Alaska and the fact that the victims are not adequately compensated. So in 2013, according to the Department of Public Safety's annual report, Alaskans suffered over $23 million in loss due to property crimes, up more than 12% from 2011. What this bill does is it strengthens Alaska's restitution laws to restore crime victims to a pre-offense condition. It amends and reconciles our two restitution statutes to make it clear for the courts that our public policy favors requiring criminals to compensate victims for their loss, which includes loss of income. Mm-hmm. So I have a couple of, I'll just give you one story. In my district this year, there was a rash of drug-related burglaries, some fairly petty, some not. But in one case, a water well drilling company, small family-owned business, someone attacked the truck for the copper wiring, removed all the welding leads, but also removed all the wiring harnesses and everything else. Right in the busiest time of year, they have one rig, and so the value of that crime is relatively low. However, that family was out of business for weeks and lost many of those jobs. So this allows the courts to consider that loss of income. It also addresses a recent appellate court decision, Welsh versus State of Alaska, which we believe adversely affects restorative justice principles. In Welsh, the appellate court overruled a lower court decision awarding the market value of restitution to a victim of property theft, stating the crime victim's loss of income should not be considered when determining restitution because it represented unjust enrichment of the crime victim. And, you know, I have some value for the rights of perpetrators in this state. I don't believe in, something in unusual punishment.
Cruel and unusual punishment.
I believe in their basic rights, but I just have a tendency to put the rights of the victim above the rights of the perpetrator. And in this case, what this bill does is allow the courts to consider the value of an item or the value of the loss of income when dealing with restitution. And with that, Madam Chair, I'm happy to hand it off to my staff for any questions or a sectional discussion.
Thank you, Senator Machicki. Mr. Kopp.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Chuck Kopp, staff to Senator Machicki. Senate Bill 5 essentially does four things, Madam Chair. It amends our Alaska restitution statutes in AS 1255045A, which speaks to restitution as a direct provision of a defendant's sentence, and directs the courts to take into account the public policy consideration that favors requiring offenders to compensate victims, victim damages and injury, including loss of income. And that is found in Section 1 of the bill. Second item it addresses is it provides a definition for loss of income as the total loss of income a business or person suffers as a result of not having the stolen property available during the time it takes to obtain a replacement. And this definition is lifted out of our Title 11 criminal statutes that courts currently use in making determinations of property value in criminal cases against property, like theft cases, burglary, criminal trespass. So it's currently language applied in the criminal law. The third thing it does, Madam Chair, in Section 3 is it gives direction to the courts in making determinations of loss or damage or restitution to value that property as the market value of the property. And the final item in Section 4 is it amends AS 1255-100, which speaks to restitution as a condition of a defendant's probation, clarifying how the court will value the property when determining the amount of actual damages or injury under this paragraph. So it reconciles this standard with the same standard in 1255-045. So what happens is currently the courts have two standards, one as a condition of sentencing in 1255-045, and one as a condition of probation in 1255-100. And because the standards are slightly different, there was a need to reconcile those so that businesses affected by crime are not in a position of not receiving compensation for income lost due to that crime. So this legislation essentially recognizes that the extent of harm caused by a crime is not fully realized when you just look at the actual, as Senator Machicki said, the loss of that copper wire, or the fact that that particular item went missing, that the actual cost is more than that. Mm-hmm. And so you could say that this just makes it clear that we're reconciling those two sections of law to show that we want that loss that is a real loss to be considered at sentencing, whether it's probation or whether it's a condition of sentence, and that anything other than the retail value is it's very difficult, sometimes impossible, to determine a fixed cost, because that value includes all the cost of staying in business, that your overhead, your labor, your utilities, everything. And when we remove that standard, businesses are truly not compensated.
Okay, questions for Mr. Kopp? And then just to let members know, we have Chris Nettles with the NFIB and Quinlan Steiner with the Public Defenders Agency. Yes, Senator Wolkowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Do you know if this impacts the amount of payments that would have to be made by the Violent Crimes Compensation Commission or Board?
Through the Chair, Senator Wilikowski, I don't think it would impact the amount of payments. The Violent Crimes Compensation Board considers, in making determinations of injury or loss, the ability of a person to make themselves whole. That's one of the things they're allowed to consider. But I don't see any that their direction in the law to make people whole is entirely different than our restitution statutes. They're not connected. They have a different set of guidelines for establishing awards.
Okay. Other questions, Senator Klotko?
Thank you, and I appreciate you bringing this forward. I was just looking again in the Article 1, Section 24 of the Constitution, where you know the whole idea of the rights of criminal victims is outlined, and restitution is certainly one of the areas. So I think we're on good footing. So I like the idea of property being part of the loss of income question, but we live in a service world too. How does that fit into a service world? For example, somebody vandalizes a building, it freezes up, and they're down for a month and a half. Is that something that's also taken into consideration?
Yes, certainly the value of goods or services in the service world is something, and that is addressed in our restitution statutes now in 1255-100. They do look at the value of goods and services.
Further questions? Senator Wilikowski.
So just looking at the definition of loss of income, it says, because we're essentially adding loss of income to this, is that correct? Okay, so if someone goes and destroys, kids are out playing and they light a fire and destroys a fishing boat, let's say, do you get the loss of income from that? Do you get the cost of the replacement of the boat also, or is that already included in current law, do you know?
To the Chair, Senator Wilikowski, the current law does cover actual damage or injury, so you could probably say my vote is appraised at $240,000. That is what I lost. And then the loss of income that you are now addressing, this additionally, it just asks the court to take it into account and puts it right up front that our public policy says the court will take this into account. So you could say it's not mandatory, but it certainly does direct them to consider that.
Senator Wilikowski.
What is the impact of insurance in this particular case? If you have insurance and your insurance covers a lot of the losses, would the criminal pay back the insurance company, or do you have given any thought to how that interaction would work?
Madam Chair, through the Chair, Senator Wilkowski, just as a fisherman myself, I know that my insurance covers my actual loss, but income, you're pretty much on your own. Unless you have maybe a special rider on your policy or something other way that you can provide for that. Maybe someone else, Madam Chair, on the committee with business experience would have a better answer than that.
Yeah, I would just say if you have professional insurance, you know, that would probably cover it. But I think that's right if it's a property issue.
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair.
Yeah, Senator Machicki.
However, the goal of the bill is to make someone whole.
Yeah.
And to be responsible for your actions. So whether insurance pays first or the perpetrator is on a long-term payment plan afterward, I think the goal is the same.
Okay, let's go to Quinlan Steiner. Mr. Steiner, are you there?
Thank you.
Testimony on Senate Bill number 5.
Hello, can you hear me?
We can.
Oh, hi, it's Quinlan Steiner, public defender for the state of Alaska. I just wanted to make myself available for questions.
Okay, questions for Mr. Steiner. Yeah, Senator Wilkowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Steiner, do you, is it, I guess I'm just curious your thoughts on this bill in terms of ability to pay and how judges are enforcing these right now, because I imagine a large percentage of the people who are convicted are incapable of paying. Do they put them on a payment plan for the rest of their life, or do they, I'm just curious to hear how this is working in the courts right now and how it might change with this law.
Certainly. Typically, when restitution is ordered, it becomes part of the judgment for the criminal case, so it could impact somebody's supervision if it were a felony. It may be part of their parole or probation requirements that they make payments to restitution. You know, as the restitution orders get large, it's often completely impossible for individuals to ever make up that kind of money. So it's a part of the judgment, and it's in effect the entire time somebody is on probation. You know, if they don't pay it after the probation lapses, it's something that businesses or individuals could pursue civilly as an alternative. But it can have an impact on somebody's supervision if they're not paying or don't make attempts to pay or have difficulty paying. It can have an impact.
Further questions for Mr. Steiner? Yeah. Is there one question?
And I think we've outlawed debtor prisons, but how are judges interpreting this when people can't make payments? Are they... That would, I guess, be a violation of their parole, putting them back in jail, or are they flexible, or how are they looking at this?
It all depends on whether or not it's a willful failure to pay. You know, if somebody has no work and no money and unable to make any kind of payment, they're unlikely to be in prison for that alone. But it can happen if somebody's not making payments. I mean, there can be a debate about that. But often what it'll do is hold up, for example, if somebody gets an SIS in order to pay restitution, if they're unable to make that payment, that could potentially impact their ability to get a suspended imposition of sentence.
Senator Wilkowski.
Do you have any perspective on whether or not we're going to end up putting a lot of people back in jail if we pass something like this?
I think this bill doesn't materially alter the way the structure works now, with the exception of one perhaps discussion, which would be the difference in a retail theft environment. The difference between the retail value and sort of the market value. Typically now when things are stolen, it's dealt with at the market value. arguably the subsection loss of income could be used to sort of make up the difference if somebody marks something up really high, but it's far exceeds its market value. You know, they can make an argument that that difference between market value and the retail is a loss of income. You know, the downside I see to that is, you know, potentially more litigation, trying to establish the likelihood that somebody would be able to sell something at that price. That's what I see its impact as. I think other parts of it are generally consistent with the way courts have interpreted this. And, you know, the restitution order is a function of sentencing versus a function of probation has been interpreted to be consistent. I think there's a misconception about the Welsh case and the basis for that case. That case didn't stand for the proposition that wholesale value of stolen property is how it's valued. It's really at market value or whatever loss the person suffers, which, you know, potentially could be retail value or typically it's considered market value. This certainly strengthens the argument that somebody has that the difference between market value and the retail price is something they can recoup. And that's why I would expect perhaps some additional litigation related to that if it comes up. I couldn't tell you how many cases that was going to be an issue in.
Senator Wilkowski?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. I don't know if the court system is planning to testify, but I'd be curious to hear, maybe you know Quinlan or somebody else knows, how much time do these take? Are you looking at I assume you're looking at a judge trial on what the loss of income, is that a pretty, you know, like a couple-hour trial, or is that a full-day or a couple-day trial? Are we looking at additional court resources being needed?
You could. It depends on the complexity of the issue. For example, one example I heard was, you know, if somebody steals or damages a motor on a fishing boat and that person is unable to participate in the opening or the season, you know, there could be substantial litigation about loss of income there, but I'm not sure that this bill actually increases that. But it would, in fact, I mean, in general, those can be quite complex because much of loss of income is speculative. But that situation in general exists now. If somebody seeks loss of income, and I don't know that it happens a lot, it can be, you know, an all-day hearing. It could be a fairly short hearing. It just depends on the complexity. But I'm not sure that this bill increases that to a substantial degree. I think in a slight degree that I described earlier, it would have an impact.
On the loss of income, do you, and this might be for the bill sponsor, unless you can answer it, Quinlan, but are we looking at a loss of income to the people who may lose jobs on that fishing boat, as well as the business owner's loss of income?
Mr. Chair, that's certainly possible, yes. If those individuals weren't able to participate in the opening and the fishing, they could argue that they are victims of that crime and potentially receive compensation, or at least a restitution order, excuse me.
Thank you.
Senator Coghill.
Quinlan, there's two things that, as I began to read this, I could see that could be in contrast to one another, and that is determining the loss of income and doing it in a time that is reasonable. And so could it be, and I'm just thinking out loud, could it be that a court would put off the judgment until they could determine what that income loss would be, or would they go back and project over the past the time that was, you know, put in and what the income was based on past? Because you might be, like, for example, in the middle of fishing season, I'm just or in the middle of welding something, you know. In this one, we're asking for a reasonable time after the crime. What would that sound like? What would that look like? Or do we already have to deal with that time frame issue?
Mr. Chair, I'm not sure I understand. Are you talking about the time it takes to conduct the hearing or the period of time in which you're estimating an income loss?
The cost of replacement within a reasonable time is under the new subsection 3.
Okay.
So then the loss of income up in sub 2 under section 2, the total loss of income of business at the time of the stolen property. So you have one that requires a time frame. The sponsor may have an answer to that.
Do you or does Nancy need? I'm seeing a nod from Nancy.
Okay.
Do you know?
I can, Madam Chair. Senator.
Actually, Madam Chair, can we start here, please?
Yes. Senator Machiki.
We're trying to solve individual cases.
Right.
So if you think about, if you want to talk about an individual case such as the fishing boat or whether or not the deckhands are compensated, fishing season lasts 6 weeks.
Yeah.
I'm not sure what kind of court scheduling you're all used to, but I don't think that's going to get in the way. I think typically that happens well after that period of time. If you're talking about other businesses, and it's a danger of going to the individual business. So I guess what I'd like to say is this bill is designed for the courts to consider. It's not designed to come up with the same decision in every case, but the reality of it is we feel, as a sponsor, that people should be responsible for perhaps not just the item, but the damage they inflict in another. When they're the perpetrator of a crime, this allows it to be considered in court. So if we want to go the black and white method on every potential effect, we could be here for several weeks, but ultimately it allows that consideration.
Yeah. And Madam Chair, maybe I didn't make my question very clear. I just saw that I understand the value of something at the time of the crime. I understand that. But then there's a requirement about replacement of the property within a reasonable time after. And I was trying to say, okay, on the principle, the formula, you have the loss of income. What's a reasonable time? That's all I was asking. I don't know if I got that question right. So,
and if I may, just for that,
Senator Machiki,
this bill is not designed to create indentured servitude. If someone does not have the ability, you know, you talk about a couple kids that start a fire on a fishing boat in Bristol Bay and they lose the $250,000 vessel and $160,000 season. Of course, kids being adults, but the reality of it is we would like to see some effort toward repayment. We realize that it may not be a judgment that returns that entire $500,000, but we do believe that the perpetrator should have some responsibility on returning what they're capable of paying in a reasonable amount of time. And I wanted that on the record so that we're not talking penny for penny, but we are talking that there's a cost over and above the fact that there's simple arson. There are impacts to that arson, and we believe the perpetrator should have some responsibility to make the victim whole due to the results of that crime.
Yeah, and I would just say, in looking at the language, the plain language of the bill, it does allow for judicial discretion still. Public policy favors requiring criminals to compensate for damages and injury, including loss of income.
Madam Chair,
yes.
If I may just respond to Senator Coghill. The place where the language came, Senator Coghill, referring to the cost of replacement of the property within a reasonable time after the crime, that's currently the language we use, that the courts use in making determinations of value in the criminal law in Title 11, Chapter 46, Subsection 980. That was a direct lift out of what we currently apply in our law.
You did say that.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
You said that at the outset of your testimony.
Oh, yeah.
Senator Wilikowski.
Thank you. And for Quinlan, I'm just trying to wrap my head around the discretion that the judge has on page 1 of the bill.
It's important.
Lines 14 and 15, it says, in determining the amount and method of payment of restitution and compensation, the court shall take into account. It doesn't say may. And then if you go down to page 2, line 16, In determining the amount of actual damage or loss for restitution under this section, the court shall value property as the market value. And then page 2, line 28, again, it says the court shall value property as market value. So can you explain what sort of discretion the courts are going to have with all those shalls in there as opposed to mays?
Mm-hmm. Through the chair, when courts assess market value for theft and damages items, they use market value. They don't deviate from that that I'm aware of. I think that most recent case, the Welsh case, was somewhat confused in the idea that this, they were assessing the marked up retail value, and that didn't necessarily relate to its market value. And there was another case recently where that was discussed. The court reversed the case where they valued the property at $500 and some odd, which made it a felony, but that was really the retail. It's market value that prevails, and in that most recent appellate court opinion, the market value was under $500 because that same item was on sale all over town for less than $500, at least the value of the sum of the property was. So I don't think courts have much leeway with regard to just the value of the property itself. There's much discussion about what market value is and how to determine it for items that aren't sold on a readily available on a some kind of market. And that's much of where the discussion of litigation comes. Market value can be very hard to determine sometimes.
Senator Wilkowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We just passed legislation last year increasing the value limit to make a crime a felony. And with this bill, are we making potentially making more crimes felonies, more property crimes felonies?
Through the chair, strictly speaking, I don't think this will advance cases from the misdemeanor to felony level in terms of property damage, which is usually how that's assessed. This deals with restitution, which would be different. You know, you might value the theft of an item at a misdemeanor or felony level, but the loss of income could be much greater than that. And that loss of income is typically not part of the theft case, which that may be slightly different in theft of services, but this isn't really moving that bar in particular.
Thank you.
We also have Chris Nettles. Let's go to Chris Nettles. He's been waiting patiently. We want to get to Senator Giesel's bill with NFIB.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Chris Nettles. I'm president of Geotech Alaska here in Anchorage. I'm testifying on behalf of the National Federation of Independent Businesses and as a business owner. We as a company are a service company. We do geotechnical and environmental analysis in the field for many other contractors. I can only state that I thank Senator McKitchie for bringing this, sponsoring this bill, because I do believe that we could see ourselves in a circumstance where theft has occurred and we would end up not being able to complete a job. And, of course, our contractors would expect us to complete that job, and this could seriously impact our contract as well as cost to replace something that might have been missing in the field. What comes to mind is an example where we had a snow machine stolen in a bush village. That occurred at the end of the job instead of the beginning of the job, but had it occurred at the beginning of the job, it may have been somewhat, at least it would have been down a day or two to get a new snow machine out there so we could complete the job. Of course, we would have been responsible for the being down for those 2 days and probably would have suffered the consequences for that. So I feel that it's important that the courts be able to consider those kinds of things that happen to a contractor or to a victim of theft. And we have certainly experienced more theft in the last 5 years, even here in Anchorage, as well as out in the bush villages. So I definitely want to see the courts be able to take into consideration our loss, not just the market loss or of the item or whatever, but certainly the contract costs that we would suffer because of the theft. That's really all I've got, other than, like I said, I'd just like to see something like this go down so that there are not issues down in the future where there are judges who can misinterpret or misapply the law.
Excellent. Questions for Mr. Nettles? Okay, thank you for your patience. All right, so this is our first hearing on it. My intention was to set it aside and bring it up next Monday with the intention of moving it out. So my thought was members could look it over, see if they have amendments, questions, etc. Prior to doing that, is there any question for Senator Machicki that you'd like to ask today from any members or Mr. Kopp? Is there any member here of the audience that wishes to testify that has not? Anyone online that has not? Okay. So we'll go ahead and set this bill aside, Senate Bill number 5, take it back up next Monday, and bring up now Senate Bill 41 by Senator Giesel, who's here in the audience. And there's a letter being passed out by Genevieve from Mr. Robert Lane, PhD. Welcome to our committee, Senator Giesel.
Thank you.
It's nice to see you here. Does it feel good to be on the other side for a little bit? A little break?
You know, Madam Chair, I don't believe I've ever had a bill before Judiciary Committee before, so this is quite exciting.
Very exciting. Well, we're happy to have you.
Should I begin?
Yes.
All right. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Senator Kathy Giesel, representing Senate District N. So the bill before you is Senate Bill 41. This is a simple bill, Madam Chair. The first question to ask yourself related to this bill is, why does government regulate, control the activities of certain professions? Barbers and hairdressers, physicians, massage therapists, teachers, etc. Well, the fundamental answer is public safety, and that's what this bill is about. The psychologists and psychological associates board that regulates this profession does not have the authority in statute to perform criminal background checks. Now you might say, well, is that important? Yes, in fact it is. This is a group of professionals that provide services to a vulnerable population. Folks that need their services are in vulnerable places in their lives. So this bill would simply give them the authority to require those criminal background checks at licensing, initial licensing, and then you'll see in the bill the word may. The board may, by regulation, this is on line 8 of page 1, okay, require an applicant for renewal of a license. So at initial licensure, knowing what the criminal background, if there are issues in the criminal background of this individual to be of concern, and then if there's reason further down the road, they can in regulation define what that might be for renewal of a license. There are 17 other regulatory boards in Alaska that do not do criminal background checks. This is not to say that they're not important for those, but perhaps they're just not relevant. It is relevant for this. This is a form of health care. It's a form of mental health care. And the sole purpose is to protect the public. So with that, Madam Chair, if you would like a sectional analysis, I have my capable staff here, Jane Conway, who can go through that with you. Otherwise, the board chair for the psychologists and psychological associates is also here to speak to the relevance of the bill for their function and public protection.
Excellent. Questions for Senator Giesel? I don't need a sectional, but do you guys? It's fairly straightforward.
Yeah, pretty straightforward. I just have one question.
Okay. Senator Machicki.
Seems perfectly reasonable that a background check would have been required. Is there a reason why it wasn't allowed in statute in the past?
Well, apparently, it has been under discussion for many years, and honestly, the board chair can speak to the time frame, and they've simply never brought it before the legislature in the past.
Okay, excellent. Board chair, I don't have your name. My apologies. Let's see here. Oh, Mr. Levy.
Levy.
Mr. Al Levy. Welcome to Senate Judiciary.
Thank you for allowing me the privilege to speak.
Thank you. And if you just put your name on the record and your title.
My name is Alan Lee Levy. I'm a licensed psychological associate. That means that I'm licensed by the state of Alaska to practice psychology. I can do anything a PhD psychologist can do except call myself doctor.
Okay.
A disappointment to my mother, but...
I'm also appearing something to be disappointed about.
Yes. Right? I'm the current chair of the Board of Psychologists and Psychological Licensing Examiners. Mm-hmm. And this, if I may address the question that was asked, why aren't we already doing it?
Yes, please.
Through the chair to Senator, forgive me, Michiki?
Yes.
Thank you.
Okay.
psychology as a profession was originally licensed in Alaska in 1963. At that time, the only background checks that were done in the early 60s were for high government positions and certain military positions as well. We didn't have the technology to do background checks as easily as we do, and the need for it was not as great as it is now. You know, 1963 was very much a different day and age that you could conduct business on the basis of handshakes and the firmness of somebody's gaze and have a pretty good sense. I grew up in Alaska, and so I know what it was like then when you could do business on a face-to-face basis. We live in a different age in which greater scrutiny over the people who are providing services to vulnerable populations is pretty much standard best practice. So the fact that it hadn't been foreseen as a need in 1963 kind of created a status quo, and status quo has a way of maintaining itself until acted on by somebody taking the initiative. For the last 8 years, the board has sought in various ways to conduct these background checks. I've been on the board for 2 years. The recent outgoing chair who has been on the board for the last 8 years, and even though we're a regulatory board, our understanding of how these things gets done has been, shall we say, less than perfect. We did find a sponsor in Senator Giza who understood the nature of the problem, and she, through the Department of Law, crafted what we consider to be an excellent bill that meets our needs without over-regulating us or tying our hands with needless language.
And I would just follow up and say, have there been incidents that give rise, complaints on the part of citizens that give rise to this idea of requiring background checks?
To our knowledge so far in the state of Alaska, we have not had a case in which somebody managed to sneak into the profession hiding some serious felony in their background.
Okay.
I am aware in other jurisdictions that this has not been the case, that there are 17 states that do not require background checks for psychologists or psychological practitioners. A lot of these states are small jurisdictions with limited budgets for doing checks, and that there have been a number of cases in which a, shall we say, an unethical person set up shop, practiced for a while, left a trail of harmed people, moved to another jurisdiction, set up shop, knowing there were no background checks being done. And so they managed to go on for a significant period of time doing significant harm to folks in the absence mm-hmm. of that scrutiny. I'd like to say that I think we've been lucky and that we have a very competent and healthy professional population of psychologists and psychological associates. But to say that just because it never happened, it never will happen, I think would be irresponsible.
And on that point, Dr. Levy, so there's a letter...
Forgive me for interrupting. It's just Mr. Levy or Al. I can't call myself Dr.
Okay, Mr. Levy, my apologies. There's a letter here from Robert Lane, PhD, asking us to explore the idea of barrier crimes. And so you just mentioned felony. And my question, I guess, is then in the background checks, will it be the board's intent to deny licenses based only on felonies, or will it be misdemeanors that are linked to, in other words, what is your intention? Have you thought that through yet for barrier crimes?
Our intention is to um, me gather my thoughts so I don't let my mouth run faster than my brain. What we intend to do is, first of all, if we can get this legislation passed, craft appropriate regulations that would answer some of these questions of what would constitute barrier crimes. The Social Work Board some years ago faced this exact question, in which a convicted murderer, convicted as a very young man, apparently went through a process of rehabilitation. I'm not sure I like that word exactly, but he went from being a murderer to graduating college and essentially had transformed himself and sought licensure as a social worker. Under the social worker regulations, he was barred from that license. What I would be leading the board to do would be to craft regulations and policies based on the best science, and I'm aware that there is research, very reliable research, that points to risk factors in various kind of crimes at various ages. I'm not prepared to answer those questions now, because that's really for the regulatory phase of this process rather than the statutory phase. We're seeking the authority to craft these regulations, and we intend to craft those regulations through an open public process, making use of the best science available to answer those questions.
Excellent. Questions from members of the committee? Senator Wilikowski.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. A few years ago, I had someone Alaskan approached me who was an accountant who didn't like the fact that they had a new policy of fingerprinting accountants for the CPA exam. And so I started to look more into this issue of privacy. And there's a huge amount of Alaskans that hate the idea of having to get fingerprinted for and this surveillance society that we're creating. And I guess my basic feeling is I agree with that feeling. I don't like where we're headed in terms of surveillance society. But as an organization, if you guys support it, if you want to, I guess who are we to say no? We shouldn't do. You know, you shouldn't be able to police yourselves. What kind of some of the questions that are in this letter get into that issue of privacy, though, and what? I guess how can, and I don't know if this is a question for you or maybe for whoever's storing this information, but how do you protect the fingerprint information from not being hacked or being distributed in another fashion, being secure?
Thank you for that question through the chair to Senator Wilikowski. I share your conflicted feelings that personal inclinations are in line with what our state constitution values, which is personal liberty, personal responsibility. But I have to balance that with my duty as a board chair to protect the public. So I struggle with this. But in terms of the practical matters of storing the information, first of all, this kind of information is covered by federal law that requires that, and also state policy that requires information obtained in a criminal background check be used only for the purpose for which it was obtained. That information will have to be stored in a very secure facility of some kind, and it cannot be shared out to anybody else. It's not public information if it's obtained by the licensing board for the purpose of determining candidates or applicants' fitness for licensure. We cannot re-share that with anyone. I don't believe it can be obtained through a records release or a public information search of any kind. That federal law governs that, as well as state policy. The actual nuts and bolts of how that information is secured, I think, would best be asked by the Department of Commerce. The Sarah Chambers is here, as well as the new director of the Department of Commerce. I think they can address the procedures. And because they're already storing that information for at least 17 other licensed professions, or no, it's more than that. I think there's 17 not covered. I think that they can address that and even answer questions as to whether or not there have been problems with the security of that information.
Senator Wilkowski.
Thank you. And the other issue that's being addressed here is, are there any look-back limitations? You may have someone who's been practicing 40 years, in their 60s, and maybe they have something which many, many years ago when they were young, which would now disqualify them. Is that something that you intend to implement?
I can speak for, we haven't made formal motion or enacted formal regulations because we don't have the authority to do so. Our general intent is to create this as a gatekeeping for future applicants, that we do not intend to require all current licensed professionals, psychologists or psychological associates, to undergo a background check under the assumption that they've been, because we haven't had this problem before, we have no reason to look in that direction. We want to have regulations that allow us the option to do that if there is reasonable cause to do so. If we get a complaint from a member of the public who claims to have been harmed in some way, that would give us, and something in that complaint would point to something in this person's background, we'd like to have the regulatory authority to investigate that. If somebody stops practicing in the state of Alaska for a number of years and their license lapses and they reapply, at that point we would intend to have a background check on them, because even if they had been practicing unblemished up to the point they stopped, their license lapsed, we don't know what happened in the interim, so we feel it would be prudent and responsible to have a background check in that case.
Two questions for you. The first is there a national registry that the Alaska Psychological Association could participate in as a result of having your psychologist and psychiatrist submit to this background check, such that they would then become a part of, we have CODIS, which is sort of a national DNA registry, but, my fear, Alaska becomes a place sometimes where folks sort of, it's a last stop.
The end of the road.
Yes. And so it helps to have a background check, but it's also nice to see sort of where folks have been and a sharing of information. Is there anything like that going on?
There is work being done on a national and somewhat limited international basis. The Association of State and Provincial Psychology Licensing Boards, of which this board is a member, has been working on that very issue about a centralized credentialing bank that would provide a central bank for storing of complaints and findings against somebody's license, but also this is to the benefit of licensed professionals in that it creates licensure portability, that with the implementation of a centralized licensing bank, a person could move from state to state much easier than they could now. That is a project that's been underway for several years, and they're making good progress. I can only speak about it in broad brushstrokes, but I believe that's something that's coming down the road within the next few years.
And that's wonderful. It's, you're dealing, right away, you think about, as the sponsor of the bill indicated, safety as a concern for the state, and you're dealing with some of the most vulnerable people in society already that are seeking out the services of your group. And then my final question is on costs. In this letter that we received, there was a discussion about would costs go up for licensing, and that's one thing we always try to look for at the legislative level, is making sure we don't create guilds or barriers to entry for folks who want an opportunity to practice, so that you're trying to reflect the reasonable costs being passed on. So how do you envision the costs being reflected with the new background check?
The cost of the background check is set by the Department of Safety.
Okay.
And I think it's around $50. I believe Ms. Chambers can answer the specifics of that. So it will not affect the cost of renewals of licensures. An initial licensure application, that person would have to pay for their own background check.
Okay.
All license boards such as ours are self-supporting, and I'm rather proud to report that we are a board that is operating significantly in the black, that we have not been in deficit for a long time, and in fact we're bringing our licensing fees down as a result of the surplus we've been carrying for so many years.
Great. Senator Wilikowski.
Yeah, on that point, it says in the proposed legislation, the board may by regulation require an applicant for renewal of a license to submit fingerprints and pay the fees. So you're the chair, you may not have the intent to require it for renewals, but it is theoretically possible that some board down the line could say, hey, we want renewals every time you reapply. And I mean, I guess, do you disagree with that, number one? Oh. Am I misreading that somehow? And then the second question is, how often are psychologists required to renew their licenses?
Through the chair to Senator Wilikowski, licenses are renewed every 2 years. We're coming up on our renewal period here at the end of this fiscal year. The question of when and how to do, you know, or whether or not to do background checks for renewal licensures, that's a regulatory issue, and it's one that I strongly believe should be conducted at the regulatory level rather than at the statutory level. The regulatory process is open, transparent. In the past, the board has proposed regulation changes that, as a result of that open process, resulted in either those regulations not being enacted or the regulations being improved by virtue of that process. I would not want to see the board's hands tied on the statutory level when we can't predict what may happen in the future. Circumstances may arise in which it may make sense to do that, to do a licensure or background check every 2 years. I can't envision that, but I don't want to tie the hands of a future board. I don't want to limit their discretion in carrying out their mandate as best they see fit. But as long as that process is open and subject to public input, I don't think we have to worry about a future board chair or a future board consensus getting a wild hair to be draconian and overly restrictive.
Okay. I'm going to go to public testimony now. Robert Lane and then Pamela Van Houten. Mr. Lane, are you there? That's all I have.
I am.
Please state your name and your affiliation that you wish to be identified with, and let's hear your testimony.
Thank you. My name is Robert Lane. I'm the Federal Advocacy Coordinator for the Alaska Psychological Association. And thank you for a minute to comment on the bill. It's been interesting to listen, and I appreciate the discussion so far. I understand that it's difficult to talk about regulations that haven't been written yet, but likewise, it's hard for us to support a bill that we don't know what we're getting into. So that was part of the reason for us bringing some things to the attention of the committee in the first place. The main thing, and I think the chair said it, is we want to make sure that our profession is able to move on and people are able to practice in the way that they've been educated and trained, and do so reasonably with a good cost. I won't go into reading the whole letter. It sounds like everybody has read it. One final comment I think that I would make in terms of, two final comments. In terms of drafting regulations, we certainly plan to be a part of that process. And then the second piece is, when I reviewed the Labor and Commerce Committee hearing, Mr. Levy reported that this bill is a revenue producer, and that kind of made us a little worried that eventually the plan is to have this as part of relicensing for everybody, despite the fact that there hasn't been a problem. We have a wonderful working relationship with the board currently, and we have had for the last few years. We value the work that they do, but the truth is we haven't always had such a good relationship with the board, and the board has always made it clear that they protect the public. It's up to us to protect our own. So that's really the purpose in writing in today. It's not that we're downright opposed to it. I think we got concerns about how far do things have to go when there hasn't been a problem. We'll certainly watch the regulation, and we want to make sure that fees aren't added that prevent people from entering into our profession.
Fair enough. Thank you very much, Mr. Lane.
Okay, next I'm going to go to Pamela Van Houten in Petersburg, Alaska.
Hello, my name is Pamela Van Houten.
Sorry about that.
And I would like to testify today in support of SB 41. First, I would like to thank Senator Kathy Geisel for sponsoring this bill. I'm strongly in favor of SB 41, requiring a background check for psychologists and psychological associates to practice in the state of Alaska as an important public safety tool. The public, when it goes in, especially in this situation, tends to be in a very vulnerable situation. And it's just kind of a client-professional relationship that is particularly open or ripe for abuse. And so to bring forward someone's criminal history or the past violations that could have occurred, whatever, that would not be appropriate to this type of professional relationship is of utmost importance. And that's really all I want to state today. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you very much. We appreciate your testimony. Okay. Anything further?
I just wanted to clear up a misunderstanding about something I was alleged was said in the Labor and Judiciary, or the Labor and Commerce Committee, I certainly do not see this bill as a revenue enhancer to the board or to the state. This bill is essentially revenue neutral in a four-point reasons for background checks document that I've shared with some folks. The idea of it being revenue positive is that if we can prevent somebody from being, from preying on the public, from causing harm, essentially we are saving money. So if you view savings as being a revenue enhancer, that prevention is always more cost effective than reaction or curing. So the cost of prosecuting, the costs of treating an individual who has been harmed and so on, these are the cost positives that I was referring to, not that I see the setting enormously high background check fees as a way of enhancing our budget. There's no need for that.
Senator Wilikowski.
I'm trying to get a handle on this because I'm looking at a fiscal note, and I don't know if this has been changed or not, but it shows that we're paying out $4,700 in FY16, and then it goes up to $20,700 in FY17 and 18, and then it goes up gradually after that. And then it also says, and I don't know where they got this information from, but it says it's for services, and services include the cost of fingerprinting applicants, which is anticipated to occur biennially, concurrent with license renewals. So at least someone in the Department of Admin Services, Division of Admin Services, and Division of Corporations is anticipating that this is going to cost $20,000+ per year, and that it will, that applicants, or rather psychologists, are going to have to give their fingerprints every 2 years. I don't know where they got that information from, but that's what the fiscal note shows.
Through the chair to Senator Wilikowski, Sarah Chambers can speak to that in more detail, but I can give you in general that if a future board decides to do biennial background checks, in order to have the authority to spend the money that comes in, the Department of Commerce has to have projected that out already, so that from Sarah Chambers' position, she has to put out the most conservative estimates of this. That's not the same thing as saying this is what will happen, but if some future board decides and manages to get that regulation through, in order to be able to have the authority to spend that money, as you know, they'll receive it in a check for this fee, but in order for them to disperse it to execute the background check, they have to have that projection on record. So it's a more of a procedural thing But again, I just restate, it's the board's intent not to do biennial background checks on already licensed professionals. We reserve, I can't tie the hands of a future board and predict exigent circumstances that may indeed justify it. So that's the reason for that. I think Sarah can speak to that more eloquently.
Respond to Senator Wilikowski's concerns. Put your name on the record for us, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Sarah Chambers. I'm the Operations Manager for the Division of Corporations Business and Professional Licensing. I would like to mention that our brand new director, today is her first day on the job, Janie Hovenden, is with me today. And I appreciate the opportunity to address the fiscal note. Chairman Levy has characterized appropriately the intent behind the fiscal note, which is to make sure that we have the expenditure authority available, because the statute does give the board the authority to potentially set biennial fingerprinting. Then we need to respond in kind to make sure that we have the authority to receipt the $51.50 per licensee. If we do not need that authority, then we can reduce that in our management plan.
Excellent. Okay. Any further questions for either of these folks? Okay, anyone here in the audience wishing to testify on Senate Bill 41? Anyone online? Okay, so we'll set this bill aside until Monday as well, allowing folks to work on any possible amendments for discussion. And we're adjourned.